Hi, this is John Carroll Lynch. I'm the director of Lucky, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 481. We have two segments on this episode. We have a San Francisco-based filmmaker named Daniel Kramer coming up in just a little while in the second segment. And I'm going to tell you in the intro for that, the circuitous route that I found myself on, which led me to meeting Daniel Kramer. But first, we have on the actor John Carroll Lynch for his second visit on the show, and it's a thrilling opportunity. He was originally on episode number 430 in September of last year with his film Lucky, the first film he directed, I believe, or feature film anyway. And when it came time to see this new film called Anything, in which he stars... I thought I gotta ask for him back to get him back on the show, and it worked out. And this time we are joined by the director of Anything, Timothy McNeil. So we'll have John and Timothy together, and the movie again is called Anything. It's a dramatic film, and it opens tomorrow, Friday. At least I know it opens at the AMC Empire 25, which is kind of coincidental. I'll be at the same movie theater tomorrow night with this film that I have been. I'm on the producing team with. I'm an associate producer on this film called Born Guilty, which premieres tomorrow as well at the AMC Empire 25. So I don't know. I'm wondering if I think did John say he was going to be in New York tonight? I can't remember, but I may run into him there. I'll be there, too, at the same theater in Times Square. Anything is about... It starts with this deeply depressed man, middle-aged man, who just lost his wife, and he's feeling suicidal himself, and he's lives down in the South, I believe, in Mississippi. His name is Early Landry. He ends up moving to... This all happens in the opening scenes. He moves to Los Angeles to be closer to his sister, who's played by Maura Tierney, and he ends up taking an apartment in Hollywood, in a kind of seedy place, I guess we'd call it, and it's sort of about the relationship that he begins with the people in the building, specifically a transgender prostitute that he ends up getting to know, and it's about that, and how that, the impact of that on him, but also on his family, and really a wonderful film. The film also stars Matt Bomer, Maura Tierney, and is executive produced by Mark Ruffalo. I really enjoyed it, and it's adapted from a play written by the director, who is joining us, Timothy McNeil. He wrote the play, and now he has directed the adaptation for the screen. We'll be talking to John and Tim. And then, if that weren't enough, we're going to then, after that, talk to the San Francisco-based filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, Daniel Kramer will be joining us in just a little bit. But I will tell you all about that during the introduction for that segment. At some point or other, you kind of fall in love with John Carroll Lynch. He's just one of those actors that you are always excited to see. Now, you know, for me, I first became aware of him in the movie Fargo, where he infamously played Marge Gunderson's husband, Norm, her loving, abiding husband, Norm Gunderson. For others, they remember first seeing John in Zodiac. Whatever it is, your experience. For instance, some of you may have just turned on episode 3, I think it was episode 3, of The Handmaid's Tale and seen him play a homosexual professor who ends up deciding his own fate. In the flashback section of that episode. He's always great. When I did meet him and talk to him on that episode way back in September, I knew I wanted to bring him back on. So here he is on Film Wax Radio with Timothy McNeil.
So Lorette told me that your wife died. So did my husband. Stomach cancer.
I'm sorry. Car wreck.
The man is 55 years old.
Yeah, and he's just been through a terrifying trauma.
I have to go into the office this morning for a little bit. You can be okay?
Of course.
You don't want to live in Hollywood.
Hollywood's not for you.
Hollywood is just far enough from you, and I mean that in the most loving way.
It's me from next door.
Hi. Where are you from?
He looks like Andy Griffith's sad brother.
It just letters from my wife when I was away in college.
How long were you married?
26 years.
I got jumped.
Why?
Why? Because Hollywood is filled with criminals.
How do people hurt each other this way?
You know, you're not supposed to be drinking on your meds.
I'm gonna say good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
So you save anyone today, superhero?
Not that I know of.
Okay, let me hear you, Timothy.
Hello?
You go by Timothy or Tim?
Tim is fine.
Tim?
Yeah. Well, say Timothy and... You know,
I have to stick with it once I start.
What do you like?
I like Tim.
Tim.
Yeah. Tim is good.
Called you Tim.
Did
Tim
you want... Oh, you have a beverage. And you've got... You're okay.
Well said. She's been nursing that since I saw him yesterday.
Because the line of questioning is so intense and so aggressive that you'll start experiencing dry mouth momentarily.
Oh, yeah.
And then you'll wish you had the water or beverage.
Should we close that door?
Yeah, probably a good idea. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, we just did the film directed, Lucky. About what was that like in
September?
September. Yeah. Oh, so it was a little okay. It was a little while ago. It just feels much more recent. How'd that go? How was that experience?
It all went great. I mean, it was very well received, and I traveled with it, and it was exciting to to have audiences all over the world see it and respond to it. So it was great.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're ready to go with to direct another soon? You think?
I'd like to direct again soon. Yeah,
But you're in demand. Apparently, so
you
that's
can't
the
stop acting.
No, I can see that. I mean, you're a busy guy. Okay, so we're with John Carroll Lynch. Go ahead.
Just moving that up a little bit.
Yeah, of course. John Carroll Lynch back for a second time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very exciting to bring you back. Although it's the third time now we've met. You know, together because there was your wife was in that movie. They had a screening at the Museum of the Movie.
That's right.
Just to refresh.
Museum of Movie Image. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Timothy McNeil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll go with Timothy. By the end of it, might be calling you Timmy. I don't know. This is your first feature that you've directed.
My first feature. Yeah.
So what? But you did have? Were you? You're an actor.
Yeah, I started as an actor, but I'm also a writer director.
Okay.
In theater.
In
mostly.
Theater.
Yeah.
Do you? I shouldn't say where. Tell me where
in
you.
In Los Angeles.
Most primarily in Los Angeles. Okay. So you write your own plays?
Yeah.
I wonder.
You wrote
I've never
this
met
play.
Anybody. This was a play.
Yeah.
That makes sense. That's right. This and this is called Anything.
Yeah.
And was that what the play was called?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm He's a good titler, by the way. That's a very
it sticks.
Seriously, you are. That's a very important skill, and your plays are well titled.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. You know.
I would normally say why you call it that, but I'm not going to because I think it's kind of a nice little.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you see the movie?
Yeah. What do you mean?
That's why he's here.
Well, you know, I do get asked that more regularly than you might think, which is I'm always surprised
by.
That
was kind of a joke, you know.
Oh, okay. It was a joke. Well, but yeah, I do get asked that.
Yeah.
More, you know, like relatively frequently, because it just speaks to that a lot of people do talk to people that haven't seen the movie, and that's always a surprise. In fact, I try to see as much as I can of the person's stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I can't see as much of, like, you know, when you're talking about the amount of acting he's done over the last 30
you'd
years.
You'd be spending the rest of your life watching John Carroll Lynch act.
Actually, that's not actually true. If you just were to just fast forward to the scenes I'm in, you could do it in probably about 20 minutes. Maybe 25.
Well.
Well, okay, there's some things that would take longer.
You're being self-deprecating, I think.
John, you were not in the were you in the play?
No, I was not in the play. As a matter of fact, okay. The person who played early was Tim. Timothy played it.
Timothy right here. Yes, so you wrote it and you starred in it.
Yeah. You can do that in Los Angeles.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think you can. Yeah. It's true. There aren't too many cases. I can't think of too many. Although there are a lot of. I mean, Molière, Shakespeare, they're all actors. Yeah, they're going back and.
Mm-hmm. Tracy Letts.
Tracy, good at that. Tracy. Does he act Letts. In his own?
No, probably
not. Okay, that doesn't
think,
count.
No, he's acted in some of his own plays.
Oh, really? Probably in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
In Chicago.
Yeah. You can do it in the hinterlands.
Right. It's harder to do here.
It's harder to do here, I'll bet.
Especially because now every Broadway play and a lot of the off-Broadway seem to be populated with big, big star names, which wasn't the case when I was growing up in New York.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just as recognized just recently, I don't know why it took me so long to realize it, that essentially Broadway has become, you know, for good or for ill, kind of like the Las Vegas Strip.
Right. It's
true.
You
know, it's for tourists to come to New York
and, absolutely true,
and enjoy really, really very famous people act.
Yeah.
And that's just what it is, and it didn't used to be fully that way. People became stars on Broadway.
That's a good point. But that's why I don't succumb to that style of theater. That's why I went to see Bruce Springsteen. Because I'm an old conventional type.
Sure, an old conventional type. You go see the Bruce Springsteen show.
How was that?
I didn't go to that. I used to work at Sony Music, which was Columbia Records or CBS Records was part of that. So I actually did get to see him back in the day.
It was funny, then, you know, people started talking about the jukebox musicals, and then they started talking about people coming to and playing, and they're like, and they're coming, and they're coming, and Bruce Springsteen is like, oh, wait, not Bruce. Bruce can do anything he wants.
That's
if he wants
true.
To play Broadway,
yeah,
that's fine with me. It's he will do a hell of a show.
Yeah, and it is a show. It's, you know, I mean, it's a different. That's always happened on the Great White Way. There were always that type of.
I watched that that documentary, the Ken Burns documentary about New York, and part of the Broadway part was you had to keep in mind the first Broadway hit was a bodybuilder in a gold lamé, diaper, posing to music. So. Let's not get too.
I played that too.
Yeah, Tim
Los
was
Angeles.
Great.
Those were the Los Angeles.
Really, you were really good in that.
Thank you.
Well, we're not going to get to the subject of at hand, which is the name is of the play, and now the film version is called Anything, and we can set it up. It's about a recent widower who's in a very, very depressed frame of mind, to say the least. He in the opening moment. It's safe to say in the opening moments he actually makes a suicide attempt. We can say that, although it's not crucial.
I think you just did. So.
Well, it's a. You know,
no, I think it is crucial. I think it's a crucial to,
show to
understand
where
he is.
Yeah,
he's there.
And isn't it at times like that where you could make such a life, your life choices, and it just reboots you as a person, right? When you have such a major dramatic life event as a death of a partner, that. Gives you almost an allowance to or get out of jail free or something to get out of your current journey and try something completely different.
If his sister hadn't dragged him to Los Angeles, we don't know what would have happened early. But then Los Angeles begins to work its spell,
insinuate its way into this. Yeah,
and I do think you're right about the idea that it's a reboot. I mean, essentially, whether or not the suicide attempt. Succeeded literally, figuratively, that person is no longer exists.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. Right. That's right. So even though you technically survived obviously, otherwise it would have been a very short film. but you do, you know, but it's you are a different person. And I mean, outwardly, you're the same person. So your sister, who obviously is very loves you very much, and is played by
Maura Tierney.
Maura Tierney, of course, great actor. She wants you to be okay. She's so she has a lot invested in your being okay. And you go on this kind of what would you call it? Like a journey, a spiritual.
I mean, I would just describe it as. I mean, I think you've put the metaphor in the right spot, which is that he's trying to find out who he is now, and there are certain things that seem to resonate with the character that seem to repeat themselves in the new version, but then there are other parts that don't anymore, and it's a matter of trying to fit them in. But it's also a precarious journey. There's no guarantee that, that in the story that Tim wrote and directed, there's no guarantee that Early's going to survive this journey either. There's no guarantee of that.
I guess just to finish the setup for it, the Early moves to Hollywood, and to which is, you know, maybe those who don't know, it's a relatively, it's like moving to Times Square back
sort
in
of,
the day.
Sort of like
back
that,
in the back in the day. It's Times Square is pretty cleaned up, so
he,
we don't really have a Times
from
Square.
West LA, which is, you know,
kind of tonier.
Tony.
Yeah.
And he moves through the social strata all the way to Hollywood.
Yeah. All the way down to Hollywood.
Well, why is this guy who, he's got some money put away, he's got means, right? Why does he choose to move to this part? You know, it's like, it's not far, the building that you move into is populated by, you know, people that are kind of struggling. You know, there's some transient types, there's some addicts, and I can understand how it make a good play, though.
Yeah.
Too, you know, because it's you have a very interesting, and it translates well to the film.
Yeah, I think when people experience something like Early did, there is a desire to move away from anything that they've known before, and I think that's particular to Southern people. If Southerners move out of the South, they will move. Well, this isn't entirely true. This is a generalization.
Yeah,
but it's true about Early. He will move towards something that's probably radically different in some people's eyes, but it's something that he's seeking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's moving towards something that he can feel, which is someplace out of his norm and out of what he's experienced before, which is what I did when I came to Los Angeles, you know?
Where are you from?
I was born in Mississippi, but I was raised in Houston.
Okay.
So it's not that radical of a difference, but it is still quite a difference. You know?
Yeah.
Los Angeles is a place of that'll set you free if you're open to it.
Huh. Okay.
I described it earlier, and it's I really do believe this is true. It's the island of misbegotten toys.
It is completely
It's,
that.
It's, you know, nobody wants a Charlie in the box.
John.
Do you feel like the South expects more of you to live more conventionally, perhaps?
Maybe it's a more ordered society.
It's more ordered a little bit?
I don't think it's necessarily just about the South.
No.
Think you can find that in Omaha and Chicago, and you can find it in lots of different places.
Yeah.
You know? But Los Angeles is a place of misbegotten toys and dreamers and filled with eros and rebellion and everybody seeking self, you know?
Yeah.
Which is crazy. A whole city of people running around looking for themselves.
Sure.
Which I love.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I like the phrase eros and rebellion.
Right.
That one hits me.
Mm-hmm. So did you, Timothy, did you always know you were going to direct the film adaptation?
No.
Was that something that
sort of became a practical? Mark Ruffalo executive produced?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And he really,
correct.
And he pushed.
I forgot that.
He pushed me towards it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said first, he said, I love this, write the script. And I thought it was because he wanted to direct it or be in it. And then he said, okay, now you're going to direct it. And I said, well, I've never directed a film. He said, oh, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I directed a lot of theater. And then, so he's the godfather of the whole thing.
Yeah, and you get a producer on and a cinematographer.
Yeah.
You're okay, right? As long as they're not going to make fun
of
you.
And I had great actors. You know, if you
can
have
you
great
name
actors,
one?
John Carroll Lynch, because he's here.
Now you've made it awkward.
It won't be the first
time. you know, that Mark and you, how long have you known each other? How long have you guys known each other?
Since 86.
So,
oh, my gosh. So did you?
32 years.
Oh, my God. Did you work with him?
He was 18 years old. And we went to the same school, the Stella Adler Academy of Acting in Los Angeles.
I see.
And when I met him, he was taking the train up from San Diego to study acting. So he was very dedicated.
You were like, you're the first person he met, it sounds like.
Almost.
You know.
Yeah, one of the first. And we became fast buddies.
Uh-huh. That's great.
Friends.
So
did a lot of theater together.
So I got involved when I was out drinking with Mark. We had a couple of drinks, and we'd worked together, I think, twice by then, or maybe three times, close to three times by then. I think it was after he directed Sympathy for Delicious, I think. But anyway, it was somewhere around there. And he told me about this play, the screenplay that was being written, and he said, you should read that. And then I got a call from him or a text from him saying, here's Tim's number, you should call him. So Tim and I met in Hollywood. We met at Mel's Diner. He sent me the script, and he met in Mel's Diner,
Mel's
and we
kind of made it. Yeah. Is it open?
Yeah, there are two of them. There's two of them. There's one in the Valley and one just south of Hollywood and Highland.
Okay, because I remember the one in
It's catty corner, almost diagonal from the Hollywood High School, right? It's not
far.
Yeah,
it's right next to Hollywood High.
So anyway, we sat down and started talking about it, and we kind of made a pact that we would do this thing.
And that was, what, 4 or 5 years ago before we did it?
Easily, yeah.
So raising money the reason it took so long to, or just schedules, or just life?
Things move like that, you know? It moved in a particular way, and I suppose if I had known more about the business, because when we sat down and talked, it was still almost felt like a fiction to me. Mm-hmm. Like it was strange. And then as we went along, it began to get momentum. And again, that was, I think, because John was attached and people were responding to the script. And so it started to grow from there. But there were long periods where it sort of sat. And I don't know, I can't remember why that was.
Mm-hmm. But it just would sit around. And this isn't self-deprecating at all. This is just the fact of the matter. You know, as I said to Tim when we first met, I said, you know, I'm happy to do this part. I love this part. I'd love to do it. But you should find someone more famous than me to do it. You'll get it done a lot faster.
Mm. Yeah, but what he's not saying and what he doesn't realize, or maybe I haven't told him, is that when I handed the script to people and I said, John Carroll Lynch is attached to play early, they went, oh, okay, and they read it.
So there you go.
That's true. He doesn't like to say that.
No, I don't know. I mean, I appreciate it, but I mean, there is, you know, there's a lot of ways that these movies take a while to do, and they have a kind of a rhythm to them. Like you said, it takes a certain amount of time, and part of it is in the pact that people make with each other to do them, and how solid that pact is, because you have to agree that it's right for both of you, and then whoever else joins. It has to be a completely agreed upon. There are no arranged marriages. It has to survive over time.
Yeah,
because there's so much pressure to so many projects and so many worthy projects, and such a limited amount of fuel.
And there was always Ruffalo whispering into my ear saying, mm-hmm. what's going on? Mm-hmm. How's the movie going? You know, that sort of thing. He opened doors when we needed him opened, so that was good.
That is good. But you had already done the play,
mm-hmm.
so I don't know. I'm not even sure I want to ask who was the actor, or if I would have known the actor in the play version, but was that... I don't know. I guess it's normal that even a play, you replace actors over time if you're lucky enough to have a long run and that type of thing. So to get somebody who's kind of different isn't usually, if they're open and they're talented.
I think that's true, you know.
It's not a big...
No. And, you know, he was a very good actor. His name is Doug Jacobs.
Mm-hmm.
Very good actor.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't
better than John? Would you be better than John Carroll? Well,
oh no, I played early.
Oh right, so you played early.
He was obviously better.
There you are. who is Doug Jones?
Doug Jacobs played.
I know who Doug Jones is.
Frieda.
He played Frieda.
Oh right. So one of the other primary characters is a
transgender person.
Yeah, woman.
Yes.
Yeah, who plays a significant role in the period of time that you're living, that Early is living.
Yeah,
in.
Frieda is Frieda. Early's next door neighbor, and she and he find much in common.
Right. And as your already skeptical or anxious sister who has a great family, and there's a number of characters, and they're more understanding and trusting in you, in Early's decisions and his and understands that he'll be okay. She's a little less sure of, yeah. of things. She's more anxious around that, and meets some of the other people in the building, and understandably is worried for you.
There's such a sense of trauma between the characters, Laurette and Early.
Yeah,
his sister. They've experienced some really seismic and fundamental trauma in their early lives that have created a bond between them that
I see.
I mean, it was so exciting to play with Maura and with Tim overseeing that it's a really beautiful relationship, but it is one without a lot of it's an intense love in a closet. They don't have a lot of they're on top of each other and emotionally on top of each other and
which could be suffocating, by the way,
for both of them.
Sure.
And neither of them really knows to some degree where one of them ends and the other begins in a lot of ways. And I'm moved by that relationship so because it feels so real and so and yet they want nothing but the best for each other.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I don't know. That's what we talked about when we were working on it, Tim. And I don't know if you have any other thoughts about that.
No, I'll say this about Laurette, because a lot of times people are looking at Laurette and not understanding the intense desire to control his life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the circumstances are really important to keep in mind when you think about Laurette. Not only that she loves her brother intensely, but she's always taken care of him. And the second piece of it is that she has learned how to, in her life in the studio system in Los Angeles, to control situations, and she believes she can control him and make it better, because that's the kind of person she is.
And she needs to.
And she needs to.
Because he's in danger.
Yeah.
And
in her, this is her perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think she's wrong about that.
No.
The choices that Early is making throughout the picture are choices of someone who might be in danger. It's that a misunderstanding of what the actual safety net is that I think they come to at the end of the movie is an understanding of the risk, the kind of risk Early is willing to take as a person that Laurette can't tolerate. And I love that too, because that really feels so true about siblings. There's some siblings who are willing to take risks that the other one is not willing to take.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes their fate.
Right. Yeah. Well, the name of the film is called Anything. It's directed by Timothy McNeil, and one of the stars is John Carroll Lynch. We could say you're the lead actor in it. That would be an accurate description. And it opens in New York City this coming Friday, May 11th, and in L.A., I think, the following week, on the 18th?
No, May 11th in L.A. as well.
Oh, okay, that got changed.
The 18th all around the country.
Okay, all right, very good.
25 cities.
25, right? Are there even 25 to open in? I didn't.
We'll find them.
Hello, Omaha.
Right. There you go. Well, you got Miami and Chicago.
Oh, you got 25 easy.
Easy?
Okay. Oh, sure, yeah. It's sure. Big country.
I won't run through them all. 25 markets.
Don't forget Seattle. Never
Seattle, that's Seattle. True. Must do open in Seattle.
Portland.
Yeah.
San Diego.
Right. So
Denver,
a lot of the West
Phoenix,
Coast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Santa
Salt
Barbara,
Lake City,
Palm Springs,
Santa Barbara,
okay,
Palm Springs.
These are all among the 25.
I'm just naming.
Oh,
spots.
You're just now naming,
naming
city. You're actually
he actually
doing
knows
it.
Where it's opening.
Austin, Houston, nice. Dallas, San Antonio, New Orleans.
Yeah, enough to say to people listening to check your local listings if there are local listings anymore. Go online and check out.
I'm hoping Pittsburgh, because that's where I'm going to be, and there's some talk that it'll open in Pittsburgh.
I think Pittsburgh. Yeah,
good.
What are you doing there?
I'm doing a new CBS All Access show called $1. It's the story of a Western Pennsylvania steel mill town,
mm-hmm.
and there's a crime at the beginning. It's a kind of a murder mystery in a way,
mm-hmm.
but it really tells the story of that town, and you follow $1 through the community. So it's a small town and a big cast. It's really exciting.
Right. Is the that dollar, is that the, what did Hitchcock call it?
Oh, the MacGuffin?
MacGuffin? It's not really a MacGuffin.
I don't think it's
case.
A MacGuffin so much as
no.
it's a, yeah, yeah, it's like a,
device.
It's a thematic device about, I think it's a device about currency.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And when's that on? I guess that'll
be
a while.
I think it starts in late August,
actually. Oh, pretty quick now.
Late August, early September, I think, is when we start showing.
And you'll be you'll be...
I got another script. I'm going to be another 5 years and you'll see it. Hopefully
maybe you'll have
sooner.
Some plays in the meantime, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
It's just always working.
Very good. Okay, so again, anything, it opens in New York and L.A. on Friday, May 11th, and then nationally thereafter.
It amoebas out to the rest of the country, May 18th.
Check it out. It's a great film, very much of the moment, I should add. All good work is, I guess, but it speaks specifically to, I think, right now anyway. And I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the support, man.
My pleasure.
This is a Mace guy in Los Angeles. I have a friend I want you to come over for dinner Saturday.
Really? Is she a prostitute?
Yes, and she has Ebola, and she's a war criminal. Everybody, this is Frida.
So, Frida, what do you do?
What?
What?
I don't understand what we're doing here. This pretending.
Obviously, I am your worst nightmare.
I will do anything to protect him.
But isn't it just love?
You're in your world, aren't you, Early? Going, going, gone.
I trust you, Early. I'm just scared.
I can do something else with my life, can't I?
I don't know a lot of things, but I know what it means to love someone.
So for many of you who listen to the show regularly, you know that all things lead back to Owner to Kell. Since we've begun this show back in 2011, not as only Owner kept popping up every so often, 8 or 9 times. Many, many, many things anyway. And many people on the show end up connecting somehow or other to my experience with him. I don't know how that is. Maybe you could make that argument with many other people that I bring on the show. You probably could. But here's my version of, or 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with this next guest, Daniel Kramer. Let's see. So I was in Owner's film in about 5 or 6 years ago called Richard's Wedding, as you may remember, because it comes up, which was a really wonderful experience because I got to be in this ensemble with all these great, talented people. And I just found it a very inspiring experience to work alongside those who really know how to act. And to see other crew that were so good at their work. And it inspired me. And after a few days of kind of rough start, I started to kind of blend in, I feel, and pulled off, a relatively good job. The point being is I think that's because of Owner and what a talent he is. And a good script, too, I will add. After the movie came out, I had the pleasure of meeting this actor who came to some party or something. I don't remember, but his name was Theodore Belukis. And for you regular listeners, you may know, remember Theodore has been on a handful of times, and I think he'll be back on soon. But he and I became friends as a result of running into each other a few times. And at some point or other, I think it was Theodore who introduced me to the works of Nathan Silver. Now, Nathan Silver is a very, very prolific independent filmmaker. As a matter of fact, I was just, as you know, came back from the Maryland Film Festival the other day, where I'd seen the latest Nathan Silver film, and in fact, and indeed, actually brought Nathan back onto the podcast for, I think, his fourth visit. And so that was great. And the year before, at the Maryland Film Festival, I had seen one of his other films called Thirst Street. And so I've been keeping up with this amazing output of films. But if you go back to the first visit with Nathan, I don't remember the year exactly, but it was probably 2012 or something like that, 2012 or 13 at the latest, he brought his mother, Cindy Silver, ends up being in most of Nathan's films, whether in very small parts or substantial roles. In Thirst Street, she has a pretty substantial role. And in this latest one, again, it's called The Great Pretender. She's there. Cindy and I have also become friends because she's like a great Jewish mom, you know? And I've kind of lost my mother, at least in part, due to dementia. So I find myself adopting other Jewish mothers. In a case, some case, they're not technically even Jewish. In Cindy Silver's case, she certainly is. So all this is to say, this long and ongoing story is all just to say that one day I get a message from this filmmaker named Daniel Kramer. Okay? And he says, Cindy Silver told me I should reach out to you and introduce my films to you. Now, she may have already mentioned him. Can't remember all the details, but this still was quite a surprise. So I ended up going back, and you can find a number of Daniel's films on Fandor, which is a streaming service of art house films. And I have a membership, and so I was able to watch, we saw Sophisticated Acquaintance, The Idiot Maker's Gravity Tour, A Trip to Swadades, A Simple Game of Catch, and Raise Your Kids on Seltzer. So you can even just tell by his titles what a peculiar individual this man is. But that's how I met Daniel Kramer, through Cindy, through Nathan, through Theodore, and through Owner. If I had not known Owner, I would have met all those other guys. I don't think. Maybe I would have. But it's certainly interesting to see this chain of connections here. Daniel Kramer grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He attended Temple University's film program in Philadelphia. In 2007, he directed his first feature-length film called Sophisticated Acquaintance, and was presented with 4 Best Documentary Prizes, Yarns to be Spun on the Way to Happy Home, in 2007, a personal essay film about having grown up with a severe stutter. Yes, he has a severe stutter. I barely noticed it, honestly. It's not the first guest. In 2008, Daniel helmed A Trip to Swadades, which was shot in black and white, super 16mm film, and won 3 Best Film Awards at international festivals. The point being is Daniel is now based in San Francisco, where he is a very prolific filmmaker himself. He is also an author. He wrote a book about the Canadian filmmaker Sidney J. Fury some time ago, and he has a new book he's working on our friend Henry Jaglom. And he's just a very, very prolific and busy individual, and I'm glad to bring him onto the show right now. This is my conversation with filmmaker Daniel Kramer here on FilmWax Radio. Thank you, Cindy. Daniel Kramer, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. There was a long gestation period for this, right?
For this
conversation, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, just Cindy Silver put us in touch, so that was a...
Yes.
She kept on getting on the case, like, you need to be on Adam's show, I'll email him, then you email him.
It's a good advocate to have on your corner.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the funny story that's very, very, very brief, I promise you. She came on the podcast with Nathan the first time that he came on with one of his earlier films, going maybe his first or second feature, and she was in it. And she was in it, of course. So, and then I got to meet her over the course of a couple of film festivals, and she was lovely. And then I was going to Woodstock, and I said, you know, I'm going to the festival. This is a few years back, and I said, and so I ended up staying with them, which was her and Harvey, her husband. And they had moved to Woodstock like a year or so before, and they were having a very difficult transition time.
It's interesting because I know Nathan. In the flesh, and so I.
He wasn't dressed when you hang out with him.
Well, I lived in New York up until about 3 years ago. So
okay,
and I get the friend request from Cindy. I was like, oh wow, the Cindy Silver, all right. And then I got sick, and then I began posting about my fight with this sepsis months back.
You had sepsis?
And of course, yeah, it was I had a badly infected wisdom tooth. I had an abscess.
Wow.
So that just bled into my ear.
I don't know if people know how serious that is, but it's life-threatening. Go ahead.
I know, yeah. So I was writing about that, and of course the mother in her comes out and you know, not even knowing me, asking me, like, you know, am I taking care of myself? Do you need anything? And there's like, and then she writes, I really love your posts. You're very passionate about film and everything. And then we just kind of began this this correspondence. Before I know it, we're like buddies online and having these, like, after a while it was like daily chats. And then, like, she watches a number of films. And I was like, you and Nathan are my favorite filmmakers. You have no idea. Whenever Nathan's friends show me their films, I always dread it because I think I'm going to hate them. And then, mm-hmm. she was like, your films are great. Why aren't you traveling with Nathan? So ever since then, yeah, she's been a major advocate. So that's my background with her, but it's, yeah, she's an interesting, fun woman, and I'm hoping to get her as a radio phone-in guest on in Overwhelm the Sky.
Where?
So I'm hoping that Nathan doesn't own the patent on using her in movies.
Oh, sure. You want to cast her? Is that what you're saying? Potentially?
A voice role. The main character in my newest, or one of my two newest features, Overwhelm the Sky, is a talk radio host. So I'm going to need a number of phone-in guests. My own mom.
Oh, I see. Very good. So I was going to ask you about your mom because, you know, I didn't know if Cindy had developed or had inserted herself as your surrogate mother. So you have a Jewish mother. So you can't have... I was going to say you can't have too many Jewish mothers, but of course you can. You can. You can have one. Sometimes is too many.
I tend to gravitate towards older people in general. So I've picked up a number of Jewish mothers over the years who kind of take on that role in my life.
Some of these Jewish mothers are even men, so I understand.
Yeah.
I know. I gravitate too because I miss my grandparents. I lost my own mother to dementia. And so I too kind of seek out that as well. I can relate to you what you're saying. Anyway, long story short, here we are. It is now April the 5th in 2018, and we were probably put together about 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, but it's always worth the wait, right? Because here we are.
Here we are, yeah.
So right now you're in San Francisco, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What brought you out to San Francisco area? What was the... motivating factor there, because you said you were living in New York.
New York kind of wore. I mean, you live there now, right?
I'm worn out, so I'm right there with you. Keep going.
Okay. So I lived there for nearly 7 years, I guess, and I arrived. I was very excited about the whole prospect of living in New York. I was just out of college. I got a job there as a video guy at a small firm that handled medical devices on the Upper East Side, and I was making a living. It just New York kind of seemed filmmaking wise. I mean, I was in with I knew a number of people in the filmmaking world in New York, including. I guess at the time I was friendly with. Larry Levine and Sophia Tikal.
Oh, okay. So maybe we met during that period, actually.
Yeah.
This is around the time of Gabby on the Roof and Green and all that time, right?
I met them around the time that Larry made Gabby, yeah.
Yeah. So I would even bet we met once before.
Might have, yeah.
Because I would be invited over to their place for parties sometimes. Around that time.
I almost cast her in a film. Well, I actually did cast her in the film I want. That's a whole other
story.
It's a film that we shot half of, and it's a freaking nightmare because we were shooting on a yacht in Sag Harbor, and this Wall Street guy who was putting up the money was just a total putz about everything, and you know, just a nervous Nelly, and he didn't like how much time we were taking with shots. And I remember he sat us down and said, "Guys," to my cinematographer, and I goes, "Guys, I'm doing this because I like to have fun, and I'm not having any fun."
Oops.
And then of course, like bringing this heavy equipment inside the yacht, which is teak wood. It's kind of furbished teak wood, and the furniture is priceless and everything, or it was to him anyway. And you know, anything that we were doing on board this thing was a no-no, and we would hear about. So everyone was nervous, and it was a bad energy. And
sure,
Sophia left early on. So that was my apocalypse. Even though Apocalypse Now is a lot bigger, you know, in scope. Mm-hmm. I kind of got the sense of waking up in the morning and saying, like, you know, who do I have to, you know, bleep to, you know, to get out of this project?
Which is the exact opposite of what normally you'd have to have bleep with to get into a project, but this was ironically getting out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was just I couldn't wait. So we threw in the towel. Mm-hmm. About halfway through, because the Wall Street guy pulled out his money, and then my producer took us to these Sag Harbor fancy schmancy parties to, you know, to get someone to make up the cost, and mm-hmm. you know, that didn't work out. So that was just a really very incredibly negative experience. Everyone who was involved in that production was just beside themselves with how much how stressful it all was.
Sorry about that.
So the opposite of that, the total opposite end of that was making Crazy Kids on Seltzer back in 2014, which I think everyone had a blast.
You can tell from watching the film, Daniel. You can just see it. You can just watching the film. You can, you know, it's just such a realized work. You know, it really.
Thank you.
It's just the center holds, if you will. Hey, wait a minute. What was that? What was that? I just heard somebody crying in the background.
That's my cat.
What's that? What's your cat's name?
Sebastian?
Tirza.
Tirza?
All right. Yeah, named after Ben-Hur's sister.
Is that true?
But that's true.
Ben-Hur's sister?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I just watched the chariot race like 2 days ago, the entire chariot race. I was over at my dad's, and he was watching Ben-Hur when I walked into the living room, and it just started, the chariot race had just started, so I just watched mesmerized. I hadn't seen it in like 10 years.
Yeah, it's, I assume you were watching it in the correct aspect ratio, please.
it was probably originally,
I saw it on a VHS.
Like a pan and scan. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this was on Turner Classic Movies channel.
Right.
Which is on constant rotation at my dad's until Judge Judy comes on. So there you go.
Well, my mom's addict of that show.
Yeah. So, by the way, I want to mention to you, just so people don't get the wrong idea about my dad, he also introduced me to Fellini and Antonioni and Bergman and Kurosawa. So, but he watches Judge Judy and Uncle and now Dr. Phil. So the old age is very, very cruel. I can only say that because he's replaced Kurosawa and Bergman with Dr. Phil and Judge Judy. Where is the,
you know, my mom is actually pretty much a cinephile too. Actually, she in her own way.
Yeah.
She'll watch mainly what I put in front of her. Then she'll on her own and tell me, like, oh yeah, I saw this foreign film. It's like, wow, how the hell did you see that? Mm-hmm. He's like, oh yeah, it's playing here in Pittsburgh and blah blah blah. So what's hilarious is that when I was home years back, we were going through the on demand, and we saw. Cindy Klein's documentary.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure.
Her husband, Andre Gregory.
Well, you know, I had them on my podcast. The two of them.
Oh yeah,
Cindy and Andre.
You know Andre.
You should listen.
Andre and Cindy. I met them actually at the Iowa Independent Film Fest in 2008, I believe. Which is Henry Jaglom and his wife Tana Frederick. They started that fest. I didn't know that.
They've also been
so,
on.
I was at the same bed and breakfast with Andre. Mm-hmm. And Cindy, so I got to have breakfasts mm-hmm. with Andre.
That's funny. Well, I think his email address, and I shouldn't give it away, but I think it's something like Another Dinner or Dinner Again or something like that. Because I ran.
I think it's called Before and After Dinner. Is the name of the mm-hmm. her film? Yeah.
Right. So I think his email was like Before Dinner. I saw him in a lobby I was walking into an event and I saw him in the lobby. And of course, you and I, I'm going to guess, are like of similar minds when, you know, you're more excited to see Andre Gregory than you would be to see somebody like, Jennifer Aniston or somebody.
I'd walk right past Jennifer Aniston.
All right. Well, I wouldn't do that. But I would still like to meet her, but I'm more excited to meet Andre Gregory because, you know, he had an impact on my mind, you know. And so, but that's funny because Henry Jaglom, he just did my podcast for the second time. I feel compelled when if you mention somebody like Larry and Sophia, they've both been on the podcast. Sophia's been on a few times over the years. Not recently, though. So almost everybody you're mentioning, Nathan, of course, and Cindy.
Everybody
except for your mother has been on the show.
Well, one day. My mom has appeared in a couple of my movies, but not like the degree to which Cindy has been in Nathan's movies. But my mom has appeared in a couple bits.
Right. Well, William Cully Allen has been in more films probably than anybody else.
Yeah. As I was saying that we were going down the lineup and mm-hmm. Cindy's movie was there and Cindy I was like, Clark. I was like, you know them. And I was like, I'd like to see it. So we watched all of it. And of course there are clips from My Dinner with Andre in the film. And so the first movie ended and she liked it and she liked him. And I was like, what's that My Dinner with Andre like? And I was like, I like it. I'm not sure if you would. It's two guys in a booth in a restaurant talking for 2 hours. And she said, do you have it down in the game room? Which is where I have all my VHS collection.
Where do you have it?
Yeah, I have it down there.
I lost you for a second. Where are your VHSs?
So my most of my collection that I accrued throughout junior high and high school and whatnot are back in Pittsburgh at my parents' place in their basement. I have a lot here too, but there are two wings of the collection. I guess I have a pretty crazy number of things just on the walls everywhere. So I ran down and I got it. And she's like, I'll just watch it for 20 minutes to see if I like it. She watched the whole thing, which blew me away. And she said, I could have watched those guys for hours. They were so interesting. I was like, wow, okay. That was, so she tends to surprise me oftentimes, which is funny because Henry, I shouldn't say this on the air.
It's okay.
Andre probably knows. Henry has never been able to get through Andre on My Dinner with Andre, even though they've known each other for a long, long time since they were kids,
which is really weird.
I'm not sure if that's good to good to air. That might right. I'm aware that Henry's not very fond of My Dinner with Andre.
It's okay to say that. I don't think Andre's listening. I do now recall Andre Gregory did one Henry Jaglom film, if I'm not incorrect.
No, he did. He did a number. He did. He was in Always. He was in Last Summer in the Hamptons.
That's the one I remember, where he gets into a very right. Yeah. That's the one where he gets on his knees and he crawls and over to this woman, and they have this very improvised. You know, you really have to be devoted to Henry Jaglom to get to watch some of these films.
It's you either are with it or you're not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's the people who follow him and will swear by him are definitely members of the cult and of the Jaglom film cult and I guess to many in many cases of the family as well, because I'm sure it's common knowledge by now, if you write Henry a fan letter, he'll and probably wind up inducting you into his little circle of friends and whatnot and confidants. I've known him for going 15 years. That was just crazy. Jeez. To think about. But
yeah, he just emailed me like a few days ago with nothing more than just the link to the new one, Zakopane. But he just sends the link, no
right.
explanation, nothing, and not remembering that I saw it a year ago, you know. We talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah, he'll resend a lot of things. Yeah. So.
But one of the more interesting things he sent me, though, a while ago, was his correspondences with Elia Kazan. Anyway, that was I was fascinated. That was really something.
Yes. Yeah, those letters could comprise a book on their own. They're pretty incredible.
I assume they were, but I don't know.
No, they're not. Okay. That I'm going to be. So I'm writing a book on Henry now, which I think you're aware of.
Oh, right.
I think those letters will be an appendix, I'm hoping, in the book. Mm-hmm. But of course, they'll be alluded to in the actual text.
Right. So is this authorized then, I guess? I mean, it sounds like you have a good relationship. Don't get me wrong. He's on board with this project?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're
collaborating.
We are collaborating. I went down and taped with him 4 days, and have to go back down there soon to fill in some gaps and begin to interview the various people that he's known over the years. This will be my third book on a film director.
What are the other two?
The first one was Sidney Fury, who is alive and well, and he's 85. Oh. Very, very close with him. Joan Micklin Silver, who is New York filmmaker, for those of you who don't know, who are known for Hester Street, Crossing the Landscape, Chilly Scenes of Winter, and I'm working on editing that currently. Yeah, so Henry's the third. So I like the whole. I guess it's good to call it the Bogdanovich approach, I guess, where you're kind of bisecting, making films of your own with I guess cinema studies or whatnot, or you know, writing monographs or books or whatever about films that you that. Impacted you or inspired you in some way, which he's done throughout his career. So I think one forms the other. The one practice of mm-hmm. making films informs mm-hmm. the film scholarship and, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So I like doing both.
Yeah, I can understand you. It in a way kind of it provides a balance to you on some level. I understand. An equilibrium. Oh, yeah. It gives you equilibrium of some sort, right? I think I mentioned this in our corresponding that I would love to get Joan Micklin on here too, because she's just not the most prolific filmmaker, but what she's made has been, yeah, I can appreciate her. So I would love to if you can at some point make that connection happen. She's been showing up at some screenings lately here in New York, Q&As. So I would love to. Get her on the podcast, do a nice in-depth conversation with her. I think that would be great.
Yeah, she's working on her own book about her adventures in making Hester Street and
Crossing Delancey.
The kind of hanging kind of Jewish history and
whatnot,
and the history of the tenements in the Lower East Side and
great
whatnot and all that. So I think she's been working on that. With another author helping her, but she's the primary. Also, she's putting on. Heard about this recently, but she was trying to. There was a guy who was interested in getting Hester Street on stage as a musical,
mm-hmm.
She'd been working with him. I'm not sure what became of that. If they're working on that still or not. So she's, you know, she keeps busy. She's also, I want to say, she's 82 or 83 right now. So
fantastic.
She's also keeping busy.
It's great. I know Henry just turned 80 a couple months ago. Okay, enough of these old farts. Let's talk about your work. I really enjoyed it. I saw, if you don't have a subscription to Fandor, get one, folks, because you can watch at least four or five works of Daniel Kramer, and I did just that. In fact, I watched Sophisticated Acquaintance, which was an early feature of yours. I think it came out in 2007. You have I saw A Trip to Swadati's. I saw The Idiot Maker's Gravity Tour, and I saw A Simple Game of Catch, and I saw Raise Your Kids on Seltzer. So come on, give me some props here. You know what I mean? I spent at least 5-6 hours watching your films the other day.
I got to hand it to you. You told me that earlier. You said I watched all of the Fandor films. I was like, oh wow, you definitely did your homework. I'm impressed. I didn't think that you'd go all 100%.
Oh yeah, no. Well, that's just that. I mean, I want to see everything else. I mean, you know, this is what I do. I do a deep dive. You know. Yeah, I did another person's podcast where we talked about, it was my choice, but we talked about the career of Stuart Rosenberg, you know, who did,
Exactly.
Pope of Greenwich Village.
Of a very obscure film he made called WUSA, which no one knows about.
I watched it.
Fascinating film.
Oh, it is very fascinating.
Has its issues, has its mm-hmm. drawbacks, but incredibly fascinating, particularly nowadays.
Exactly.
It's very pertinent, very timely.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's so far ahead of its time, even if it's a bit of a flawed experiment. And, you know, it stars Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and I think a miscast Anthony Perkins. I'm a big fan of Anthony Perkins, but I think he was miscast in that. Although, you know, they lean on his
lanky stuttering thing.
Yeah, but also his sort of sexual ambiguousness. Uh-huh. Anyway, I still felt he was a bit, I don't know. Anyway, I don't want to get too caught up in that, but I agree with you. And also, an even more obscure film that Stuart Rosenberg did called Move. Have you seen that one?
Oh, yeah, Move with Elliot Gould, yeah.
And Paula,
which is really a lost artifact. Maybe Fox, their archive collection, I think they put it out.
I have a copy.
Yeah, for a long time I had that on VHS, back when I was
in Pittsburgh,
high school,
yeah.
I would say. Because I had a thing for New York art film, particularly mayoral eras of New York as they exist on film, almost like I call them like mayoral auteurs. There's a very identifiable Mayor Lindsay, New York, New York, Ed Koch, New York, mm-hmm. Dave Dinkins, New York. It's very, and of course, there's the early Koch and the late Koch.
Right.
Kind of like the, you know,
yeah,
early Preminger and late Preminger.
Well, it's funny because, yeah, I was thinking about that too, and I was thinking about curating like a series. You know, and I was thinking about these films that were about, well, sort of, I was thinking more like, I was trying to figure out the connective thread, and I was thinking maybe like real estate or New York anxiety, mm-hmm. you know, and Move is in there, and there's a lot of films about living in New York over the years in the 70s and 80s that deal with the anxiety of urban life in New York. And
I mean, there's the classic film that cannot be overwatched, in my opinion, and that is Midnight Cowboy, which is my favorite, my personal favorite Oscar-winning film.
Right.
Just because
of
that, I love that grimy, that Mayor Lindsay dilapidated, dangerous, New York. I can't get enough of it. I don't know how many times I've seen that film now, but I'm obsessed with it.
Well, you can watch it on, I believe it's coming onto the Criterion Collection in May, just in a couple of weeks, so. Good plug on your end there.
Yeah.
I know. I just watched it again. And I think at this time, the thing that got me was John Voight's performance. I was particularly moved by John Voight's performance.
Yeah, I like that. And I'm a counterculture film.
Me too.
Obsessive. So the guy I visited when I was last in New York, who mm-hmm. who restored the only existing print of a Magic Garden of Stanley Sweetheart, which is a New York counterculture film released by MGM in 1970. But he and I are like, we will always bounce on about counterculture cinema. of that era. But I mean, the party scene in Midnight Cowboy is, I mean, I want to crawl inside that. I think I've taken shrooms and listened to the Old Man Willow, whatchamacallit, that tune that plays during the party scene. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I was with a friend. I was like, I know just the tune to play, and it's the weirdest drug experience I've ever had. I don't know.
But did you wake up in bed with Brenda Vaccaro? That's the question.
Oh, I did not.
No such luck.
I did.
Okay. So, speaking of the counterculture, it's a good way segueing into the Idiot Maker's Gravity Tour, because your main character, I would say, is definitely a product of the counterculture.
Yes, absolutely. And that was, in its own way, my wink and a tip of the hat to that era, that school of filmmaking and everything from the... I guess it was just a reaction to that being the counterculture film of the 60s being a particular cinematic G spot for me, I guess. So I coupled it with Bill's, the main actor's actual life story, or I guess most of it are fragments of it, and then putting that into kind of a new 60s kind of road film as it would exist in, I guess at the time it was 2010.
Well, tell me then, who is this Bill Allen, and how did you come to meet him and learn his story and cast him in several of your films?
Who is Bill Allen, and why is he saying these wonderful things about me? film reference. No, Bill. Bill is my lucky charm. He's been in every single film of mine.
He has? Oh, okay.
Since Sophocles, he hasn't missed. He was just out here doing just a year ago. He was out here a year ago. Because I'm saying just because I'm still editing the film a year later, doing his scenes for Overwhelm the Sky. Mm-hmm. Which is my current project, and I need to find a role for him in Even Just, which is this new film I'm doing. But Bill was a professor of Eastern religions at my alma mater, Temple University, and I was in his class, and he was so invigorated and animated and eccentric, and you know, just one of those professors that, you know, you're not really even paying attention to what he's saying as much as, like, you know, the performative aspect and as far as I'm concerned, there are few people as inventive as Bill when the stars are aligned, which is often mm-hmm. with him. He can really deliver some gems in the middle of a scene that you can never write. Bill is just one of these people that. So I cast him. So I was helping him with editing footage he'd shot in India back in 2006 or 2007. I was doing my thesis film at Temple, with A Trip to Swadadis, mm-hmm. which was shot on film and everything, and that was. Super 16, and I had a student crew, which was kind of a lot of people buzzing around, and I didn't have the role of the mom and pop store clerk that I needed for one of the opening scenes, and I was kind of bugging out because I needed to find. I was like, oh, Bill might be interesting, I said, Bill, do you want to do this little role in my project here, graduation. My capstone project. He goes, oh yeah, absolutely. I always wanted to be a mom and pop store clerk. And then of course he improvises these crazy things right in the middle of the scene shooting film, which is nerve wracking mm-hmm. because, you know, the camera would mimic the noise and he makes a little, the Aton XDR probably make the, and then, you know, so every time it did that, it would be $1, $1, $1. So you gotta make every moment count, every frame count. But so, you know, going out, it was probably the only film I've ever completely scripted, but letting him go out on a limb.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to see where he would go on another movie. So I did a short comedy film called A Collection of Pentacles in 2009. And I was like, oh, we're in business. I think I got my trademark actor here. Kind of like, I think Barry Levinson has Ralph Bakken, I think his name is, who's in all of his films up until, I think, his last one. Last one that Ralph appeared in, it was Liberty Heights. I think he died after that.
Oh.
But that was like his Lucky Charm or, you know, whatnot. So Bill is in a Kramer film without Bill. I always try to figure out, you know, who is Bill going to be with each film. And so by the time I'm going off to India with him to do this other documentary project, I was in an Orthodox Jewish yeshiva looking to be a rabbi at that point, which is another, my evolution in the Jewish world is, you know, kind of its own.
You buried the lead.
What's that?
You buried the lead.
Yeah, it's an interesting arc that I've had over the years. Maybe if we have time, we could touch on later.
Series of podcasts. Go ahead.
I was going out to India with him and everyone, and I hadn't made a film. As far as I was convinced, I was out of the film game at that point because I had a very negative experience in L.A. and Hollywood, and I convinced myself that I couldn't do it. I couldn't exist in a business where these type of incidents were regular events. So I was about to go off there to India, and everyone said, "Well, why don't you do one last hurrah film? You're going to be there with your actor in this amazing location." And all I had was my little, forget the name of it. It was the PD 170, little rinky dink, DV cam, camera that I think Lynch shot Inland Empire on. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do there. It's just, I might as well just, you know, do what Bill wants me to do and just go and just do that. So by then, on the way over, this kind of lightning bolt hit me. I was like, oh yeah, Bill told me that backstory of his life and being on the road back in the 60s, traveling cross country and, you know, leaving his family when he was 16, dropped out of high school at the time. And hitchhiked across country to California, and his adventures on the road. I was like, oh yeah, that would be an interesting film—a guy going to India. Then the ball got rolling, and about the time I landed, I said, Bill, we're going to do this other movie here. So we shot a lot, and then I came back to India twice more after that to continue shooting it. And I wound up with this accidental feature, this unexpected accidental feature.
Right.
And that's how Eddie Murphy's Gravity Tour got made. So that film.
Well, it feels incredibly improvised.
I saw again for the first time in years.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just mentioning that it feels very, it has a very improvised feel, not surprisingly, but you saw it the first time in a long time recently?
Yeah, I must have been for the first time in at least 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as with anything, there are things that I like a great deal in it. And there are things that I don't like in it that I would not do the same today. I mean, all things, you know, everything said and done, you know, I revert back to the old line that a lot of the filmmakers say. It's like, I really wouldn't change a thing, even though I have the kind of the retroactive urge to kind of re-edit a couple things, I believe that films are snapshots of who you were at the time that were made.
Right.
So I would rather not do that. So even though I've been tempted to do an alternate, a completely different film, kind of the way that Jacques Rivette did, he edited another film out of the footage of La Belle Noiseuse and a number of other films. He also did that. He made Divertimento out of La Belle Noiseuse. He did.
That was like a 5-6 hour film or something, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. So
that was a really long film.
Noises was 4 hours.
Okay, 4 hours.
Divertimento was two. Yeah, Divertimento was two.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very different films. So at one point I had the urge to maybe do that with this because we shot a lot. But yeah, I've got other things to do, and you know, and then to be hung up on an old project that is fine to exist as it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, no regrets. It's a very strange film. It either turns people off in a very, very definitive, marked way, or it people get a groove on with it. Cindy Silver. So Azer Conegdo and that film are her two favorites of mine.
Wait, which one? What are the two favorites?
She wrote this incredible, lengthy, you know, diatribe this whole lengthy thing about how she found it meaningful, and for a child of that age herself, it was very on point and
right. Oh, I see.
Whatnot. She identified with
Bill's character is what you know is my guess.
Yeah.
So that was her way.
There was that film, and then I did Simple Game of Catch after that, mostly with one actress and one on one set, mostly there are a couple scenes that are outside, but and that's that one is my own mom's favorite, and a couple, and my I'm actually part of a filmmaking collective.
Mm-hmm.
Out here, which is why I answer your earlier question, which I didn't, which is the reason why I moved out here was to join this collective.
What's the name of the collective?
We're having a group screening two nights from now. So two of the members of that group, they're fans of Catch the most. That's their favorite. It's like a novella or short story film.
Mm-hmm.
Which I just kind of did on the fly with, you know, and I like it. I like that one.
What's it called? Cat?
Simple Game of Catch.
A Simple Game of Catch, of course. Yeah. What's the name of the collective, Daniel?
Bricolage Films, even though we're
okay, saw that.
Might be on the verge of renaming, because now we have like Bader-Meinhof syndrome. We see the name everywhere, and we all think that we should name ourselves something different. For now, we're Bricolage Films. We actually have a website at bricolagefilms.com.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're a seven person filmmaking group. Actually, you were just at the Queen's World Film Festival.
Well, I feel it's how to, I guess I am a posting on social media, so I'm assuming that's how you saw that. Yeah. Yes, I did go there. Yeah, I just was able to fortunately squeeze in a day when my son was out of town, I guess.
Yeah. So one of my partner's films just screened there.
Oh, which one?
Knowing Nothing Cold. It won the Best Ensemble Prize.
Okay.
Because I did see a movie that reminded me of you, and it was shot in Vietnam, I think. And the main character really reminded me of Bill.
Oh, interesting.
I have to put you in touch with this film.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. We'll do it, you know, at some later point, but...
Cool. So, yeah, Jeff Gao is his name, just won the Ensemble Prize, which is it's a very good film. Apart from any allegiances I have to Jeff, my friend, that's one of the best films I saw last year. Top 10.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get a film like that out there. But it's a period film set in the Midwest 70s about kind of like a Linkletter meets PLA or I don't know something along those lines. It's a very beautiful mm-hmm. coming of age type of film.
Okay.
Were you going to say something?
No. I appreciate the recommendation and the plug for that other film. It's interesting. There's only seven of you in that collective. That's a nice size. You know, like the Brooklyn Film Collective. There's one here, and it's much much bigger, I guess. But I guess there's so many filmmakers. Jesus, in Brooklyn, it's ridiculous.
Well, we kind of use the Rob Nielsen. I mean, he's kind of the grandfather or the patriarch of the group is Rob Nielsen. So right. We've all worked with him. He's a number of my films, I guess, at this point, and he's appeared in, and he's, I guess we all are tied with him in some way. We all have ties to him in some way. I shot Azer Kanado, which is the film that I finished after 5 years of editing, just finished this past November. So Rob is one of the key actors in that. But I came out, I was, as part of the company where I worked in New York, they would ship me out to San Francisco once a year for their conference. So kind of handling all the video operations there. So the guy who's handling the webcasting room and I got very close, and this is my partner on Azer Kanado, Dennis Demir. And, we were chatting for a while and I said, so do you make your own films? And he's like, oh yeah, I'm working on a road movie called American Mongrel. And I was like, oh, I just made a road movie in India, so which I happen to have a copy on me at that point. And so he brought his previous film, Not I, in, and we traded discs. And then the next day we were very impressed with each other's work. And he was interested in the fact that I'm come from a Jewish background, and he comes from a Polish background, born in Poland. So we went on a 6-hour bar odyssey after the conference one night, where he was asking me questions about Jews and how it tied into his history and his heritage as a Pole, the frictions between two groups. And then we left each other that night saying we should make a movie about what we just talked about. So I came back out basically a year later on the nose for the next conference, and we shot most of the movie on that trip. And then, so basically I met all these people doing that film, and it was just this incredible chemistry and energy. I wasn't used to in New York this idea of like meeting people and then saying, oh, you're working on a movie. Oh, can I do this? Can I do camera work? You know, can I boom? Can I do sound? And I was like, wow, this is usually in New York. It's more, in my experience, more every man for himself type of deal. I made a couple films in New York, but I didn't get a sense of community like I did.
Really?
Rob kind of promulgated in a way, in a very profound way.
Well, I have to disagree. I mean, I think there is a very, very strong film community, but it's highly, highly anti-Semitic. So if you're okay with that, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Just to top off that point, I wound up commuting out from New York again. At that point, I was living in the Bay Area when I made Seltzer. When I made his Kids on Seltzer.
Yeah, which we didn't even get to, but I do want to recommend it to people. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it's my personal favorite of my own film so far. Coming back out to work with the same crew, and my cinematographer came with me on that trip, and he saw the kind of the energy, and he was also looking to bust out. He's been working with me for 10 years now. He's been my shooter, and I said, hey, do you want to move out here? So we went and had these on a U-Haul, and we've made our way out.
Wow!
So that's why I'm in SF. So it's good.
Wow!
So yeah, I've made since I've been here. I guess I've finished editing Mizzy's on Seltzer here. Finished editing either here. I shot Overwhelm the Sky, which is in editing right now, which seeming more and more epic by the day. This will be my longest film, I think, by a wide margin. And working on this little pickup feature called Even Just, which I'm shooting Mondays.
Even Just.
So, which is about, which is actually based. I got the idea partly because I work in a film, a motion picture film lab out here. So. I'm doing film scanning, color correcting, film splicing, and whatnot. So we get a lot of hobbyists coming in by the day, who are not in the film world. They're not really filmmakers or even in the film industry. But they just either collect other people's home movies and get them transferred. For what purpose? Right. I don't know. Or they shoot and they don't. They just like to collect images.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the idea of like a guy who's not in the film world. So I came up with the idea of a lawyer, kind of a disreputable lawyer. An ambulance chaser who's an image collector whose father worked for Most Film in Russia. And he's a son of a Russian immigrant. And he just loses his retirement savings because he's more of a dreamer. So it's based partly also, based on the guys who come into our shop here, but also based on Kieslowski's Camera Buff, which is a really, really incredible film, which if you haven't seen it.
I think that's the one that's on this list of films that I need to see, because I've seen quite a bit of his other content, you know, like Decalogue and everything else after.
Sure.
Just about. Probably not everything, but...
Yeah, Camera Buff was his breakthrough. Right. That kind of shut him up to the movie heaven, I guess. the Moscow Film Festival, and that kind of made him... that helped to make him who he is. I actually... gave a copy of that film to my bosses to borrow, and so they just watched it this past week because I've been talking about it. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of doing a version, my own version of a Camera Buff, and so they saw it. They, of course, loved it because it's a guy just living for shooting 8mm film and gradually becoming a filmmaker. He gets a camera to film his child when she's born.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the first person in his little Polish town to get a movie camera. So he just becomes this. It begins to take over his life, I guess, much to the chagrin of his wife and his boss begins asking him to make these industrial films. And everything. So the idea is that this lawyer is much more consumed by collecting images and shooting whatever touches his fancy, even going to aside, there was a on Christmas Day where I live in Bernal Heights, which is a neighborhood off the Mission here in SF. So on Christmas Day, the house two doors down from us had a big fire, big blaze.
Mm-hmm.
One house was totaled, and the other house next to it got pretty badly burned. So we were very lucky. We got out fine. Our house was in okay shape. It was untouched. Six more feet, maybe not so much.
Right.
But there's a burn down building, and I hadn't been that close to a house fire in my life. That was pretty scary. Using this house that's totaled, having the lawyer character go to it, and then of course he's supposed to be doing other things there as part of his job, but he pulls out his little 8mm movie camera and begins to get all these arty angles of the house and everything. So it's kind of it's an interesting project. We're working on it on Mondays using mostly actors that I've never worked with in the past, and it's been fun. I've been enjoying the process, and it's just like a pickup feature, I like to call them. One man band going out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing my own sound, I'm my own shooter. Once every 5 years, I tell my cinematographer to back off, and I'll do this on my own, which you can kind of do in ways. So it's like playing your instrument. It's like exercise, I guess.
Well, it sounds like cathartic too.
So working on that, working on Overwhelm, and life is busy, and it's good, and working on books, and it's good.
Where can people, obviously you got a bunch of stuff on Fandor, and where else can people find some of your work, or if they're interested are you on Vimeo, or?
I am on Vimeo. There are a lot of trailers on there. There aren't really any whole films. There might be.
Right.
I remember my Vimeo stock on there. But I'm on Vimeo websites. My collective is BricolageFilms.com. We're having, as of this recording, having a showing, a group showing in Oakland in 2 days on Saturday night. And so that's my collective. And then my personal site is ConfluenceFilm.com, ConfluenceFilm.com. Mm-hmm. And Pandora, Vimeo, well, they're all, you know.
And we'll bring you back on as soon as we can make that happen. So maybe while you're here in New York, soon, we can do another if you end up coming in.
Great.
I should mention, I just received an email. I know that you probably are a fan of the film Five Easy Pieces.
Oh, of course.
The actress Susan Ansbach just died, apparently.
Susan Ansbach?
Yeah.
Only 75 years old, but she passed away today. But she was you could say she also part of the counterculture and the film work she did. And she passed away Monday, so that would have been, I guess they're just reporting it now. It's several days later. She appeared in the off-Broadway version of Hair, and then went on to make films such as The Landlord. Of course, we were discussing New York films. Hal Ashby's first feature, Bloom in Love with
Bloom in Love.
George Siegel,
right, and Five Easy Pieces, of course.
Paul Mazursky,
right.
Yeah. Anyway, so
I was wondering where she, you know, what happened to her, because she had, I haven't seen her anything in many, many years.
Did she marry Dennis Hopper? Was she one of the many women who married Dennis Hopper?
Well, let's see here. But she worked with some of the great filmmakers of the day, that's for sure. She was born in Queens, it turns out. Where I was born. Let's see, she received a full scholarship to the Catholic University of America. After college, she moved to New York, and she fell in with then-struggling actors like Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. She made her stage debut in 1965 in the off-Broadway play A View from the Bridge, which also starred Voight and Robert Duvall, obscure actors of the day, I assume. Ansbach worked with into her 60s in films. Doesn't mention husbands, though, here, unless I missed it. Interesting.
Yeah.
Doesn't go into much into her love life in this particular article. People should see, I mean, those...
She was in Play It Again, Sam.
Yep, she was in Play It Again, Sam.
She was a wife who runs out on Woody in Play It Again, Sam. I remember that.
Yeah, well, she was prophetic in that regard. Yeah. Well, there you go. She'll be missed. She was great. Did some great work. Susan Ansbach. All right, buddy. It's 11 o'clock here, so I'm kind of winding down.
Yeah, but, yeah, you too.
It was
thank
truly,
you.
Truly great.
Thank you for doing all the background work. It's good to talk to someone who's watched these things.
This was truly great to connect with you and so thanks to Cindy Silver.
Yeah,
and I'm sure if nothing else, we'll get her off our back.
I actually told her earlier that I was going to be, because she messaged me earlier. And said, I'm recording with Adam tonight. He's like, oh, wonderful, great. Well, yeah, she was very excited. Of course, her use of emojis is always very charming.
She's listening, and she knows we love her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, I'm sure she's listening, so she knows how we both adore her, and we'll dedicate this episode to Cindy Silver. And thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, have a good night.
Talk soon.
Talk soon. You know, I keep asking everybody to do it. I'm looking here now, and we are up to 97 ratings. That's up about 15 from I did a little email blast. Can you get me over the 100 hump this week? As I post this episode, it's Thursday, May 10th. I would love by the 12th to have three more reviews. And if you put your name in the review or some moniker in which I can reference you, I will mention you on the next episode and thank you personally. So if you are, let's just even say the next bunch, I will start thanking everybody for their kind reviews. It actually does work. I did a little bit of a test where I went to I went on iTunes and I went to the TV and film category of podcasts, and I searched, I clicked on a few different shows that are in the film category, as I mentioned, and my show came at the bottom. They have other shows you may be interested in, right? You like this one, maybe you like that one. So my show comes up just because there was a bunch of reviews. Now, why is that important? Because when people are looking for film people, there are many people out there like yourself possibly who really dig listening to film talk. And when they'll click on my show because they'll see it. If it's buried and other shows are coming up and not mine, they won't see it. So I want everybody to succeed, I suppose, but I want to succeed more. That's it. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. I've mentioned this a bunch of times, but do you know that I'm putting up every segment from every show? It's going to take a long time, of course. I put them up as the new shows come out, but I'm also going back and putting up old segments. But you can go to listen to, obviously, the John Carroll Lynch segment from today's show. You can also go on there and find the last one. And then what I'm doing is, because YouTube lets you make playlists, is you can also get the John Carroll Lynch playlist and listen to two segments that he's been on back to back and just listen to them in a row. And you can get like a full hour of talk from maybe one of your favorite actors. Well, I'm going to put one together for, let's say, somebody like Owner, who's been on 8 times. That's hours and hours of Owner you could just listen to in one sitting. Another popular guest is Frederick Wiseman. And I'm going to put those segments all together in a playlist, the Frederick Wiseman playlist. You know, I think people will love to listen to the show in that way. And not only that, but there are some cases where I've done Q&As that have been recorded, and I'm going to occasionally even be able to put something like that in the playlist. Something I can't podcast, but I could put on maybe YouTube and make it part of a playlist for a particular guest. Anyhow, that's it. So I just want to remind people again, I will be tomorrow night at the AMC Empire 25 with Max Heller, the director of Born Guilty, and various members of the cast and crew will be in attending. So if you are free tomorrow for the 7 p.m. screening, come on out. Otherwise, any screenings there. Again, it's called Born Guilty. It's opening in a bunch of cities around the country, though, so you can look it up. It stars Rosanna Arquette. She is single, but she's the mother of a grown man who lives in L.A. as an advertising professional, and she's in New York. She's a social worker, and she's always in crisis mode, you know, psychologically, emotionally, and she's constantly calling her son, and he's trying to focus on his work, his career, his relationship with his girlfriend and everything, and she kind of insinuates herself to the degree where he can't quite escape from that. And what does he do? One day, his old college friend, this zenned out, blissed out guy that he was very close with once, shows up at his doorstep, wants to borrow money for an entrepreneurial idea he has, and our lead character, Marty, his name is Marty, he agrees to do it, except that his friend has to go and earn the money by going back east and helping to heal his mother. And what happens in this intergenerational rom-com, but they fall in love. Anyway, Born Guilty, it's opening up on Friday, May 11th. Do check it out. Again, I will be at the 7 p.m. screening at the AMC Empire 25 in Times Square tomorrow evening, Friday, May 11th. So maybe I'll see you there. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Adam Sharto. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. It's been episode 481. We'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode. We may have some additional episodes coming up. with my Montclair Film Festival coverage, with my Maryland Film Festival coverage. So there's a lot of great stuff coming up with all that. So keep tuning in. Remember to take care of yourself and the ones you love, please. We'll see you soon. Take care. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs.